Today is February 15, 1994. This is Margaret Van Cleve. I will be interviewing June MacDonald, who spent much of her youth in Selawik and other bush communities during the 1920s and 30s. This tape is made possible by a grant from Igloo No. 4 Foundation, Pioneers of Alaska. We are recording in the MacDonald home on Adak Street in Fairbanks, Alaska. Like many pioneers of your era, you are of the generation whose parents came to Alaska primarily for mining. Oftentimes that meant living in isolated areas. What were the circumstances that brought you and your family to Selawik?
Well, my mother and dad were living at the time in Candle, and the superintendent of the schools, he had 5 or 11 villages that he was superintendent over, and he lived in Kotzebue, and he had asked my folks if they would come to Selawik to teach, and after some consideration they decided to go, and that's how they came to Selawik to teach at the little schoolhouse there.
And that was in
1928?
Uh-huh. What were their names?
Iris Ward Perkypile was my dad, and Sarah Ellen was my mother, and they both, my dad, of course, had been in the country since 1904, off and on, but my mother came in 1917 to Fairbanks, to Candle.
And she had come to work, or was she?
No, she had come to visit her brother there in Candle. And Joe Whitehead was his name, and that's where she met my dad. And my dad was mining there, and they were married in Nome in 1918, and then they came back to Candle where they lived and for a while, and then of course they went outside for a while too, where I was born later on. Out there.
So it took a while before they got into the teaching.
Right, right. There was other things they did.
Well, how did one get around or get to Selawik in those days?
Well, it was by boat or plane, and we went, of course, by boat. So it was a big family of us then. There was my two sisters and myself and mother and dad, and we all went in a boat to Kotzebue, and then from Kotzebue we took a larger boat and went up to Selawik, up the Selawik River. We had to go through, cross two lakes, Cobalt Lake and Selawik Lake, and then up the Selawik River to where the village was.
Mm-hmm. That took quite a long time, but you were only a year old.
No. Well, at that time I was 3, but I still don't remember except what the family tells me of that trip there.
Do you remember much about the house that you lived in Selawik?
Yes, I do. That's one thing. Of course, I was there till I was 13, so a lot of the things I can remember that happened there in Selawik. And the house was, we had the schoolhouse, 2 rooms, and they were attached to the living quarters. And we had a nice living room and kitchen, and my dad had an office where he had his dispensary with his medicines and things that he used to help to work with the Eskimos that were sick. If anything in the village, he was almost like a regular doctor, because there was at that time there wasn't any doctors coming there. The closest doctor was in Kotzebue. And so my dad had to do a lot of the medical conditions, had to take care of if there was any problems in the village there, until we later on had a traveling nurse who helped my dad when she'd come. And she usually came like twice a year, something like that.
So dispensing medicine went along with the teaching job.
Yes, and the post office. They had the post office there too. Mm-hmm. So everything kind of ran together.
So sort of the hub of the community.
Right, the schoolhouse was. where they all came. There wasn't, except for the Friends Church, that was the only two places where the people would gather. It was the schoolhouse mm-hmm. or the church. So there wasn't any other places.
Not even a general store.
Yes, we did have a general store. We did have one. And the only white child I remember was the couple that ran the store when we were there. And they had one boy. And that was the only other
family
that I ever remember being there. You know, mm-hmm. that they had other storekeepers, but they were more from around Selawik area there mm-hmm. that ran the place.
That, how many people lived in Selawik, including your family and other white people? Was it a fairly sizable Native community? Or?
Well, at that time there was 300 people, and when we went back later on, the population had come up some to 700, and which we thought was seemed like a busy place then with 700
well, that's
people
more than double in size.
From 300 to 700.
Talk a little bit about the school routine. Did your mother teach the lower grades, and then your father?
Yes.
Taught?
Right. My mother taught the first through the fourth, and my dad taught fifth through eighth. And the rooms were connected with a door so that you couldn't hear the other classes in the next room.
But you did have access back and
forth.
Yes,
back and forth. And my mother had the largest class with so many little ones, and then my dad had the upper grades there. Mm-hmm. So his class wasn't as big as mother's. And I think back on the number of students, I think there was about around 60 students, and mm-hmm. most of them were in my mother's class.
Okay. Uh-huh. So there was a dropout rate then with the older students?
Yes, they didn't go, well, we had, I think, two that went to through eighth grade and high school, went on, well, they couldn't go through high school, they had to leave to go to Klutna at that time was mm-hmm. the school where they could go further in their education.
Yeah, it was before they had regional.
Right, so they didn't have anything for them to do, you know, any correspondence courses or anything mm-hmm. like that at that time, I guess, because I don't remember that.
But, did most of the students speak English, or?
Yes, they did. And when they would go home, they were supposed to speak in English, too, to help the elders, their parents. And a lot of the parents did speak, but a lot of the older people, the grandparents, a lot of them spoke in Eskimo. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the children knew both languages. They were speaking in Eskimo besides in the English language. So it...
So they actually came to school knowing English.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And my sister, she took on the Eskimo language till she was my dad's interpreter. And so whenever he wanted to find out what, you know, they were speaking about, he would have my sister interpret for him. She became very good at it, too.
Yeah, that would be Inupiat or Yupik. Yupik.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's the southern region.
Yes.
And I guess school would start in August, late August, and go...
Yes, and then it would wind up in April, because at that time they wanted, the Eskimos left the village, and they went up, what we said, up river to the fish camps, where they would cut their logs, and they would fish, and they would... take care of like muskrat hunting was mm-hmm. one of their main things, getting skins to sell so they'd have a little money for when they came to the stores to have to be able to trade off the skins for mm-hmm. groceries and things like that there.
And that would involve the whole family, I suppose.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So that would account
uh-huh.
for some students not completing elementary education. They were needed on the farm, so to speak.
Right. But they would, so that's the way my mother and dad planned it, for them to be through in April. I don't know if it was probably around the middle or something of that order, because they had to go to their camps with the dog teams. So they had to go while the ice was still solid
Solid,
and
right.
travel upriver.
Yeah, speaking of recreate, well, that's work, but recreation. Did you get out and do a lot of recreational activities like sledding and skiing and things like that?
Yes, we did. Not so much skiing, but sledding. And we had made snow houses, and they were very sturdy ho houses, almost like igloos, because the snow packed so hard with the when they had the blizzards and winds up there, which we had quite often. It would pack the snow so hard you could walk on top of it without any problem. And so we would make these snow houses that we really enjoyed. And even mother and dad have come out and stood up in them. So they were quite big.
So at
And
least 6 feet tall and
we played a lot in our snow houses.
just like a playhouse that kids have in the more temperate climates.
Then we had these, of course, our neighbors lived nearby with some of the children we played with every day. And this one time we were there when the snowstorm came up, and it was a regular blizzard. And when it was ready, time for us to go back home, which we were only three houses away, but you couldn't see a thing because of the blizzard. So the two of the Eskimos there got a rope, and they one took the front of the rope, and the other took the back end, and they put us in the middle, holding on to this rope to take us to the schoolhouse, because otherwise we'd been blown away. It was so strong, and so that's how we got home that day after having a fun time playing with our friends. Well, I can remember that because it was so unusual to just be a few houses away and not be
Not be
able
able to
to
see.
get, not be able to see your place or anything. A little scary too.
Oh, goodness, I'll say. But what about, we talked about transportation, getting to Selawik. I suppose your folks used dog teams to, or hired dog
Well,
teams if you ever
we
needed dog
ourselves,
place.
well, right, you could hire dog teams because we didn't have any, we just had pets, just not sleigh dogs. And so we didn't have a team, but in the summer, our transportation was my dad had built a boat for us, and he called it the Canark, which was another story there because my brother was born in Selawik. My brother David and the Eskimos gave him the name of Canark, and Canark in Selawik was the hero of the village from way back. And so that was a special name for him. So my dad named the boat Canark, and that's what we traveled in up and down the rivers and down the lakes to Kotzebue, and that was our mode of transportation.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned that your brother was born in Selawik, but there was no hospital at the time. What facility, I guess.
No, we had there was a lady there that, or in fact, her husband was Archie Ferguson. He was a pilot around there too, and he had a store there that he ran, and she helped deliver my brother and all. Her name was Hadley Ferguson, and she and between her and my dad, they delivered my brother. And we were praying for a brother because there
That's right,
was
three girls.
three girls, so we needed a brother.
Oh, what time of year was that? In the summer or?
My brother was born November
Oh.
22nd. He just turned 65, and just recently, so that's been
65
many
years
years
ago.
ago. Our baby brother.
Guess he's always that. Oh, like I guess holidays were pretty special there, as they are everywhere. What do you remember about, let's say, Thanksgiving and Christmas? Those are always big holidays to kids, especially.
Right. Well, Thanksgiving, I particularly remember this one time Mother had invited this neighbor we had across the river from us, and he was a taxidermist, and he was a Greek and had come from Athens. And so Mother had invited him to have Thanksgiving dinner with us, but he never did clean himself up that much and wash his hands that much. So when we all sat down at the table, we had this corn on the cob that Mother had saved especially for this Thanksgiving dinner, and it came in cans. And I don't think I've seen it in cans for many years now, but that was a special thing she'd saved for this special Thanksgiving dinner. So we were all just so anxious and waiting so for this corn on the cob. When our neighbor, his name was Sapolio, he decided to tell us a story about in Athens, and he picked up the corn cobs and demonstrated the pillars in Athens and had all the corn out on the table. And by that time, our faces dropped, Mother said, because we could see we wouldn't be eating it after he had used
Thoroughly handled
it, handled it all.
to build the
So,
Parthenon.
right, so that was one of the instances that I remember so clearly about our Thanksgiving dinner. But then Christmas was a very special time for everyone. Besides us, the whole village entered in the Christmas spirit. And we always had at the schoolhouse the big Christmas tree, and the men would go up to the Upper Selwick, and that's where all the big trees were. I think it was about 50 miles out of the village upriver. And they'd bring this tree. So it was a special time to have, because around Selwick there was just willows and there wasn't any trees of any size around there. So this having a tree, and it would be from the floor to the ceiling. So it really impressed me as a child to see
Big,
that
huge tree.
huge tree. And the children would make all the decorations for it right there, because we never bought decorations. They were all made. And by the time it was just covered just beautifully with all their decorations that they had made. So then the people from all over the village would come, and we'd have a special program. Mother'd have the Christmas story, and played out with the Eskimos and ourselves, having little parts in it to say. And the parents of the Eskimos were always so delighted to hear their children taking part in the program and having a say in these verses that they would tell, and they really enjoyed that. And Mother used to say, oh, I could they just laughed and giggled because they enjoyed that so much. So then the gifts were brought in too and put around the tree, and we had a regular party. And then afterwards we usually had something like Christmas cookies and hot chocolate and that type of thing. And then the other big day was at the Friends Church, and that was the only church there in Selwick at the time. And they had a special gathering there, and their Christmas was different than what we had at the schoolhouse. They had gifts that they would run on wires clear across the church building. And they'd string up, they'd oh, nothing would be wrapped. It would be like mukluks and parkies and they'd have
A lot of homemade gifts then.
mittens, all homemade. Everything
How
was
nice.
homemade. And they made their own tags, and they were really neat. My sister said a lot of them were made of birch bark. I couldn't remember that part.
Oh,
I
the
know
tags were
the
made of,
tags, birch bark,
and
and cardboard. But they were always fancy, fixed up, and it looked a lot nicer than our homemade one, than our made, bought ones.
Yeah, manufactured.
Or the manufactured ones.
Oh,
yeah.
So all these gifts so, would be strung up. And,
yes, they'd be strung up across the church rooms there, several, and along the sides, they'd have so many things, and then they'd have, like, people would pick berries during the summer, and they'd have gifts of berries. In fact, my mother was given berries in a seal poke, salmon berries. And so it was always special treats like that that they would have, besides all the things that they made, the fur things and that type of thing. Uh-huh. But they never had a tree there. The tree was always in the schoolhouse.
And that was the only tree in town.
That was the only tree in town, right.
And everybody had a hand, you say, in decorating it?
Yes, all the school children. Uh-huh.
What sort of things would they make? Would they use paper?
Mostly the paper, and make the chains, and then the cranberries stringing, and the different things like that. Popcorn.
I was going to say popcorn.
Oh, right, popcorn. So it did look very beautifully, I think.
In fact,
I think when I think back on those days, I think, well, I should, once in a while we'd pop popcorn when the kids were growing up and put it on the tree, but nothing ever looked as nice as what we used to have there in Selawik, to my notion.
See trees like that anymore.
No, yeah, they had huge branches and beautifully, well, they would make a special picking of the trees, I think, as they, to bring to the village.
That was probably a spruce tree.
Yes,
nice,
uh-huh.
They're nice and bushy when they're that big.
Right.
Well, you made do with making a lot of your things, but
yes.
I guess there were certain things you had to buy, like your shoes. Did you wear...
Yes, well, mostly...
Sears catalog shoes.
So, the catalog. We ordered from the catalog, but most of it was we were wearing mukluks and in the winter. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, in the summer, we did have shoes that we had. Or they called, like, summer parkies. We had calico parkies that the natives would make for us. And we had those for the summer. And that's what they used. They had, in the winter, they'd wear their furs next to them with the calico parkie over top of it, and then in the summer they would put away their winter furs and they would just use the calico part.
So year-round parka.
Right, it was very versatile.
Didn't need a whole big wardrobe.
Right,
kind of.
They didn't need that much.
People got by with a lot less in those
days.
Yes,
you didn't miss it either.
Did your father do any hunting?
Well, yes, my father did hunt, and he taught my older sister Muriel how to hunt, and she did a lot of getting birds, and we had ducks and geese and that was the main ones.
What about caribou?
We didn't have caribou there. We had reindeer. That was another source of meat. Uh-huh. We had, and my dad was superintendent there, headed it up, the herd, and they would have a certain time in the winter when they would bring part of the herd in close to the village, and then they would kill enough meat, or the deer, for to take care of the village.
Uh-huh. And your canned corn probably came up on boat the
spring
before.
It came a long way.
Or the summer before.
Because the folks had to order their groceries a year ahead of time, because there was only one boat that came in to Kotzebue, and we would go down, pick up the groceries from Selawik. We'd go in this boat I was telling you about that we went down and pick up the groceries and bring them back to Selawik. And that had to last us all winter, almost till the next summer again, when we went again to pick up the groceries.
Yeah, it's quite a bit of advanced planning.
Right, very much so. Because thinking of myself, I gotta go to the store.
Run to the grocery store every 2 days.
Every time, yeah, right. I'm always, it's so handy just to run
yeah,
down.
So you're only a mile away
no,
from that
I know it, very close.
And so you lived in other villages too while you were growing up, or did you stay most of the time in Selawik?
No, we moved from Selawik in the summer of 1928, and my dad had purchased a store in Ruby and Poor Man area. Actually, the store was in Poor Man, and a roadhouse attached with it, and a post office. And so we moved there, and it was a mining town. And my dad, of course, was always interested in mining because that's what he did a lot of in Candle. Mm-hmm. So we had the mining, the mines there, and we lived there. I was only there about 1 year or a winter in Poor Man, and then I came to Fairbanks.
Oh, this is about the time you went to high school?
Yes, when I took my freshman year here in Fairbanks.
So did they have elementary school in Poor Man?
No, there was no school. My mother taught us.
Oh, so
we had what they called the Calvert course, a correspondence course there in Poor Man. And up because when I left, I was 13 when I landed there in Ruby. So I was right close to high school, so I needed the eighth grade. I hadn't finished the eighth grade, so I did it by correspondence and then came to Fairbanks for my first year of high school.
Oh, and that would have been Fairbanks High School, what we call now Old Main?
Yes, it was called, well, it was called Fairbanks Public Schools, too.
Mm-hmm.
But it is. It's Old Main, and it's the toughest school in Fairbanks, I think. Toughest
still
building.
Still standing.
The hardy one. Right.
And what year was that you came
when
to?
When we came to Ruby.
No, to
Fairbanks. Oh, to Fairbanks. I came in 38 to Fairbanks.
And so you boarded with some friends?
Yes, we boarded with Mr. and Mrs. George Hicks, and they were a family that had been here for many years, and she took in other children too and boarded them. So that's where we were. My sister Norma was with me, and she was finishing up her junior year when I was starting my freshman year. So then we stayed there till the following fall, and then we went out to Seattle.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the territory, Alaska, of course, is a territory then, did not pick up the cost of sending students who had no high school to other communities such as Fairbanks.
I don't think there was anything
they did that later,
then.
But,
yes,
but
I don't
then.
Think at that time, because the folks decided that it was a little expensive living here in Fairbanks for us, so they decided to send us out to my aunt. It was my dad's brother's wife and family in Seattle. And that's where I finished my 3 years of high school.
Oh.
And I graduated there in Seattle.
So you didn't get back and forth to Alaska, I guess.
No, I was gone 3 years. And in all those 3 years, I never did see my mother until I graduated and came back home.
And home by that time was still Poor Man.
It was still Poor Man. Uh huh.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, after 3 years, what did it seem like coming back to Poor Man?
Well, I tell you, everybody laughed at us because we got lost in Poor Man. We got off the plane and the little airfield was above the town there, and we had to come down a little path to cross the Poor Man River and come to where the store was and where the family was. And we came in a little earlier than what they expected, and the family weren't there to meet us. So we took off and tried to find home, and we got off a little bit, and everybody says, how can you get lost in a little town like Poor Man? So we had a lot of fun over that.
So you would have come home right after graduation.
Yes, in 45 I graduated. In 42. I graduated in 42.
Oh, so the war had already started then.
Yes, the war had started, and we came back on the Alaska steamship, and at that time they were darkening the windows. Everything was blackouts because they were afraid the Japs would see any lights or anything like that. They were trying to keep it from the Japanese spotting anything like that, because they were already in the Aleutians, so
they'd
come
in.
Uh-huh. So they were very cautious over that. And then we came to Valdez, docked at Valdez, and then came up on the bus to Fairbanks again.
Mm-hmm.
And we stayed overnight, maybe two nights, at the old Nordale Hotel.
Oh.
I'll never forget that.
Oh, that was
that was a special time.
Yes. Oh,
while we waited to take the bush plane to poor man.
Well, Eva McGowan there to make sure you got settled.
Yes, Eva was quite a friend. She was really a very neat lady. We sure miss her.
She took a lot of people under her wing.
She did. She always helped. She was always helping someone. And I know she helped us too, and we never forgot that.
So it was really quite a lengthy trip to get home with different modes of transportation, and then I guess the plane would go out just once a week from Fairbanks to Poor Man.
Poor Man. I think it flew down like once a week, but it would fly to other villages like it, to Ruby and other areas. They were always in the flying. The planes were always moving. They had several pilots that they had. Jim Dodson ran the air service here, and at that time that were flying to the bush. So we had several good pilots, and Eddie Steger, whose sister is Aga, he flew down to Poor Man too. He used to come in there, so we had people we knew coming and taking us back and forth, and we always had a good trip, no accidents.
Well, bush pilots are the best, they say. I think they certainly.
And we landed on Old Weeks Field, which now is the housing area, and the big hangars were right there, and the one hangar that used to be Pan Am Hangar is where the bowling alley is now.
Oh, Arctic Bowl.
We used to land right there on that, practically probably where the library is now, in that area.
Walk from the airport to the Nordale Hotel from there.
Right, it wasn't far. Yeah. We walked everywhere. We didn't have any cars to drive at that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, so we walked everywhere when we were in school there at the time. I forgot to mention that my mother's father, our grandfather, lived with us in Selawik, and he was always taking a boat and going up the rivers and fishing and hunting, and he just loved that part of it. So when we moved to Poor Man, it wasn't anything like that. And my grandfather just about wilted, because he loved to get out and hunt birds, and there was hardly anything there and very little fishing. So it really, Grandpa was never too happy in Poor Man.
How did Poor Man compare to Selawik in terms of size of the community and facilities such as medical?
Poor Man had more facilities than Selawik, but Selawik had a traveling nurse that came about twice a year, and her name was Alma Carlson, and my dad built with the help of the Eskimos, built a little cabin for her so, there in Selawik. So when she traveled to Selawik, she'd have a place of her own to stay. And he built a dispensary there for her, too. And she, in turn, would go to the other villages. There was 11 villages she had to cover. And when she was through up there, she'd put in 18 years in the North Country, traveling to the villages and helping people and giving inoculations and that type of thing, taking care of them.
Well, I guess things like diphtheria were still a real problem back then.
And all those hard diseases, measles, and hard measles and all those things were really bad.
Did you have any epidemics while you were a child or serious illnesses?
No, we didn't have. Of course, we had a lot of wonderful care with Mother and Dad taking care of us so well, but there was a whole family wiped out with tuberculosis there, and they were little friends that we played with all the time, and it was just very sad. I think the oldest girl and her mother were the only two out of this family of about seven, and so we remember that, and we all ended up with scars on our lungs. But if it hadn't been for Mother's good care and Dad's, we probably would have ended up with tuberculosis too. So when we have our x-rays, there's always scars there on our lungs.
Showing
that we were exposed to it.
And I guess that continued to be a problem up until the mid-50s.
Right. And it seems like it's come back a little bit now. I've heard more about it again, that tuberculosis is cropping up.
Yes. Thought it was a disease of the past.
Right.
So, well, when you jump ahead, or where we were talking a little bit earlier about coming back to Poor Man after you graduated from high school, did you stay for another year, or did you just stay for the summer?
No, I just stayed for several months there, and then in the fall, I came up to Fairbanks. And we rented, I had my sister, my younger sister, Audrey, and my brother, David, they were still in school. So we rented this little place, and I went out and got a job out on Old Ladd Field. And while they were in school, I was working. And I had several jobs out there, but the one that was the most interesting and the one I enjoyed the most was working with Marcelle Cope. And we worked in mail and records, and she was headed up the office there, and so I was there, I believe, about 3 years that I worked there, and it was quite an interesting time for me then.
Mm-hmm. Say, housing, you lived, you rented a house right downtown?
Yes, uh-huh. It was right down, it was close to where the municipal utilities power plant is now, only on the opposite side of the street. And it was a house that used to belong to, I'm sorry, I can't remember the name.
But it was on First Avenue?
Yes, it was on First Avenue. Uh-huh. Yes.
And how would you get to work? That'd be quite a little commute.
Well, we had a bus that took all the people that were working out on Ladd Field from downtown. You went down on corner of Cushman and 2nd there, and the bus came in, and you caught this bus out to Ladd Field. So you walked, though, from where you lived, because we walked everywhere anyway.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was a lot better shape then than I am now,
well, now people really,
for all this walking.
People work hard jogging down at the gym.
Right, right.
Walk around town, they wouldn't need to do that. Was the bus a city bus, a private contractor bus, like Griman's bus, or was it?
Yes, it was Griman's.
Oh,
Griman,
so he
took the run, and then Billy Root had a run too. But I mainly remember Griman at the time, Griman's taking us. They had several buses that they'd pick up, because there was quite a few people working at that time out on the base. So
that was the main source of
work and employment then at that time.
Really changed Fairbanks a lot.
Oh, it sure did.
I guess with so many new people in town, it really made Fairbanks seem like a bustling community. Well, I guess it really was. Just the pace of life picked up. Did it seem quite a bit different during those days, during the war?
During the war? Well, it did, because I, of course, had been here before when I was taking my freshman year, and it was a small town, what you would call small, 2,000 people, 2,500, that. Mm-hmm. But with the war years coming, a lot of people moved in from, like my folks came back from Poor Man, because Poor Man was shut down, the mining was through at that time, and the people all came to Fairbanks or went elsewhere. And my folks came back up to Fairbanks to live, and my dad worked on the base too, and was a guard out there. So we were, until later on, they returned to Poor Man, but they just went back to settle up things and come back again. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so really, mining shut down completely, and I guess
right.
It really forced a lot of people to make some quick decisions
right.
as to what
and
they were going to do.
This is it, and a lot of the men that worked in the mines were young men, and of course they were taken in the service. I had one brother-in-law that was taken in, had to go from leave Poor Man to go into the service, and the other one went to the Lucians where he was working down there. He wasn't in the service because he was married and had a family at that time, but later on they came back to Fairbanks, too.
Mm-hmm. In the meantime, you had met your husband. Was he in Fairbanks during the war?
Yes. He spent most his war... he was in the Army, and he was on detached service from the engineers. And the reason he was, his group that he... The group that he belonged to in the service went on outside, but he was kept here because he was a heavy equipment operator, and he cleared the runways, he ran the graders and the equipment, and kept the runways cleared of snow in the winter, and in the summer he was always on his equipment out there. So they kept him here. In fact, one of the officers even had him showing him how to run a Caterpillar tractor out on his days off, showing him how to run the equipment. So I met Colin the first time in high school when I was in my first year of high.
Oh, so and then you hadn't seen him all that time?
No,
until
then
you came back?
Until I came back and into Fairbanks again. And I met him at the USO. We used to go down there and they had a well-chaperoned where they had a bunch of, they called them the USO girls. Mm-hmm. And anybody in Fairbanks that wanted to could belong to it. And we were chaperoned by several of the town women. And they'd have their dances down there a couple times a week. And we also traveled to Big Delta and Northway entertaining the soldiers.
You mentioned the USO. That was the old building. I guess it's near where Golden Heart Park is on First Avenue.
Yes, that's where it was, right in there. And once a week, I believe it was, that the townspeople would give the soldier boys a special dinner, and so all the people and whoever wanted to contribute to this dinner could, and they did that time after time. I remember the people bringing food there, and I thought that was very special and very neat for the people to do that. But they wanted to help out the war effort too by having something there for the soldiers. And
that was downstairs in that basement?
Yes, they had it downstairs, and they also would sometimes have it upstairs.
As I recall, mm-hmm. it was a two-story
yes,
building.
Two-story, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yes. And
the dances would be in the
dances
basement?
Would be upstairs.
Oh, upstairs. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Oh, and then I suppose you had a live band in those days. Fairbanks had some fine bands.
Well, even taped music sometimes, we had. But it was always good. We had the old-fashioned dances one night, like the schottisches and the polkas, and then another night we'd have the modern dancing with the jitterbugging and mm-hmm. and the other types of dancing. So it was very interesting. Those were
Did Colin play in the band?
Colin never played there for the dances, but in fact, that's where I met him again for the first time after I had left. I had met him in high school, mm-hmm. and when I came back, of course, I joined the USO, and it was at one of those dances that he came and asked me for a dance. So he said he hardly ever came in there to the USO. So we had a dance, and then we had a date, and that's how our courtship started.
I guess many a courtship started there.
Right, I think so. And we were married in 1945, and he was in his uniform then. We were married in September of 45, and then in the spring, the following spring, he was out of the service then. Mm-hmm. So he was
had grown up in Fairbanks.
Yes, Colin had he was born in Anchorage, but he came to Fairbanks when he was two with his family. So he was raised here in Fairbanks.
So this is really home from
yes.
age 2 on.
Right.
Yeah, his father was Donald McDonald.
Yes.
Father of the Alaska Highway.
Right,
McDonalds are long-time
Alaskans, right.
Contributors to what's gone on, certainly with highways.
With the highways. He was most noted for that. That he worked with the railroad, too, mm-hmm. at the time.
So after the war, you settled down in Fairbanks for good.
Yes, uh-huh. We settled down here. Carl and I were married, and we bought us a little house, and we're lived in Fairbanks off and on ever since.
See, after the war, there certainly was another change in terms of more people coming and the construction of the Northward Building. Or what are some of the other things that you remember happening at that particular period, right after the war, early 50s?
Well, it seemed like there was a little slump there after the war. Of course, everything was so busy at that mm-hmm. time, at the time of the war. But then buildings went up, and a lot of it, of course, was during the war. And like you were saying, like the Northward Building and some of these other buildings that went up, I'm trying to remember, like the Penny's Building I know there's a lot of other buildings that went up. Office mm-hmm. buildings went up, and in fact, where the Key Bank was used to be Ken Murray's Insurance above the bank. That used to be the First National Bank on the lower floor, and then mm-hmm. upstairs was offices. And that's where I went to work after I left the base. I went to work for Ken Murray Insurance there for about 3 years I was there. So there was a lot of changes. And at that time, there was only myself and Ken. And then eventually, he spread out and he had a lot of workers working for him.
Yeah, uh-huh. a big firm.
No.
Yeah, of course, along with all the building after the war, there were a couple of bad fires.
The Nordale burned down, and also the Lathrop had a bad mm-hmm. fire.
I was thinking that 1946 was the year of the two really bad fires. One at
the co-op.
Yes, the co-op.
Yes, the co-op was a bad fire. In fact, Colin took pictures of that too. We've got some old movies way back mm-hmm. on the co-op fire. That was quite a fire. Yes, and so all a lot of those places have built up and changed names, and my husband knows what every building what was there
before.
what there is now, but I don't remember all that, but he does. He remembers
mm-hmm.
what places were where. And I told him he should write a book on it. What
yeah,
buildings
to... He could illustrate.
Right, he could illustrate with the pictures.
So you continued working until your first child was born, or did you work...
Well, I worked up until, let's see, 1953, when our first boy came along. And then I just stayed home. Once the children were here, I was busy taking care of raising the boys.
Yeah, I always think of you and your husband when I think of the Salvation Army. And that organization was certainly a savior during the 1967 flood. And I thought that you were involved in it at that time, but... Was it a little bit later?
Yes, it was in the 70s that we came in to be at the Salvation Army. And my husband, we were both going there. They have a what they call a corps. And they also have their religious side. They have a chapel there connected with their offices. And we started coming there to their meetings in their chapel. And then, of course, we went on and became what they call soldiers. You join the Salvation Army and you become a soldier in their corps. And so then the captain that was there, when the pipeline was coming in, the captain, Ronald Emery, asked my husband if he would be able to help with... getting a shelter going, because there was all these people coming that they expected to come to Fairbanks when the pipeline was going strong. And so my husband took over the running the shelter, and it was a 26-bed room. It had 26 rooms there for the people that came in that needed places to go and didn't have any place to stay. And so we worked there with that, and then later on we were asked if we would want to run the Salvation Army when the previous officers had left, if we would be willing to become captains in the Salvation Army. And so we had to take correspondence courses. It was equivalent of 2 years of college, so we both had to take that course in order to be able to be in charge of the Salvation Army here in Fairbanks. So we went in and worked with that. Right now, I don't know how we ever did it, because we were both, I was close to 50 and my husband was already 51 or 2 at the time. And so it was just like it was very interesting work, and we really wouldn't have changed it for the world, what we did there. But right now, I think we retired at a good age, because we were a little worn out by
the
time.
So you were both involved in that?
Right. They take you as a couple.
Oh,
uh-huh.
Yes.
They take you as a couple. So you both have to have the same... You have to have the same education, and in order to, I ran the women's group. We had a women's, what we call the home league, and then also I worked with the children. They have a little group you call the Sunbeams, a bunch of little girls, and I had them, and then my husband had we had some of the boys, and they had a... my husband took care of them and worked with the boys. And of course, we had the Sunday schools, and he ran the chapel service, and I helped him with that too. So he was the one bringing the messages and having that part of it. And then working in the community, and we had the stores, and we had one, the main store downtown, and then we had one out at college and one out at North Pole, too. So we were quite involved in all that.
Overseeing all of that.
Right, So we spread out quite a bit.
24-hour job, it
sounds right,
like.
And there's no end to it.
So the headquarters are in New York or in London?
No, New York. Mm-hmm. Well,
international.
Yes, it's in London. But the main head of the all over the U.S. is in New York City.
And so there are ranks in the service. You mentioned that your husband was a captain, and what were you called?
Well, we were both auxiliary captains. We both had the same rank, but the reason we were auxiliary captains, because we couldn't go to their training school, which is in California, because we were too old. They have a cutoff age there in about 35 or 36 in that area, and we were too old for that, so we took the correspondence course. And so we were auxiliary captains at the time, but if you were in for 5 years, this has happened since we left there, you become a regular captain.
Oh, if you go in as
right.
an auxiliary.
Right. You go in as an auxiliary, and if you're in for 5 years, you become a regular captain. But they started that after we'd already retired.
So some people, I guess, do make a career of
service. Right. Oh, yes.
And they seem to move around after serving so many years in one place.
Yes, they do. They move around. Usually, I think probably the captain that came in after us was here about 5 years, five, 6 years, but that was quite a while. So usually 2 years or after that. Some are only here a year, you know, and then they're moved to other areas.
So you served here for the duration?
We did our, right, we did ours, because that's what we felt. This was where we'd been raised and was...
And you saw a need for it.
Right, we saw the need, and that's why we went into it like we did.
Where was the Salvation Army headquarters located at that time, the shelter, for instance?
Well, the shelter was originally there on Gaffney. But when they bought this new one, when my husband came in to help, they bought the building. It used to be a funeral home there. This is many years back. And they converted it. It had been into an apartment house. There had been before the Salvation Army bought it. And then they converted it into rooms and built up a kitchen and had a little area there that they had for offices, and but it was on a big scale then during the pipeline because they just were filled overflowing, and then later the mission, the Fairbanks Rescue Mission came in
and took over
a lot. So between the Rescue Mission and the Fairbanks and the Salvation Army shelter, it took care of a lot of people that way.
So a lot of the people that were housed were young men that came up thinking that they could instantly get on the pipeline, and they had no place to go.
For work and families, children, and we had to have, like, the women we had on the upper floor had rooms for them, and then the men were on the lower floor there, so that there was no problems between the, except for the family men, you know. But there was quite a lot of people in town, and my, it just boomed. I don't think it was all for the better for Fairbanks, because we had a lot of problems and a lot of troubles.
Well, did people have a limit as to how long they could stay?
And they paid
on a sliding scale if they had
Well,
money.
They were able to work, too. A lot of them helped in the thrift store and in the shelter area there, and helped with the kitchen in the kitchen area, in the offices, and different things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it looks like you've spent most of your years here in Fairbanks, certainly since World War II. Have you ever been back to Sillooet?
Yes, we made a trip in 1988. We decided, my three sisters and my brother and myself, that we wanted to return after 50 years of being gone from the village. We'd all had that desire to return. So we, in August, my husband and my three sisters, my sister Muriel and Norma and Audrey and my brother David, besides two cousins that had been writing back and forth for many years, decided they wanted to go on this trip to Sillooet.
Safari.
So my cousin Blanche and her and cousin Loretta, they decided to come, and they came from Newark, New Jersey, which big cities back there. So they had never been in anything like that at all in the village, had never come to a village, but they did very well with us. They fitted right in with everyone up there.
Oh, I guess probably the first thing you want to do is see if there's anybody
We knew. Yes, and the place we stayed was prearranged with a lady we had known and gone to school with, Marie Clark. She had been Marie Burnett, and she had two houses there, and so she put us up in one of the houses she had there, and took care of us, fed us, and was really a real lovely lady. And so then from there we would go around the village and visiting the different ones we remembered, they had at the time we were there, that many years back, there wasn't any bridges across the river. Everything was, you went by boat, or in the winter you walked across it. But since we were there in 88, they had two bridges across the river, which was really different for us to be able to walk across the river.
So even and, change in Sillooet.
Yes, and the surprising thing is one of our nephews, Phil Anderson, who works for Earth Movers, helped with the bridges up there and building the bridges. So we thought that was pretty neat. He would come back and tell us about Sillooet.
Yeah, the modern changes.
Right, the changes there.
But it was quite a contrast to your earlier trips into Sillooet. You flew, commercial airline to...
Yes, we flew with Alaska Airlines up to Kotzebue. Mm-hmm. And, well, I'll go back away. My brother flew his own plane. And his wife, Angie, and our son, Alan, flew with him all the way to Sillooet. They made the trip in his plane. But the rest of us took the commercial plane and flew to Kotzebue. And then we changed planes to a smaller plane and flew from Kotzebue to Sillooet. And I can remember seeing all that water. I never realized there was so much water around Sillooet Village, because I guess I'd never flown over it before. We'd always gone out of Sillooet
by boat.
Kotzebue. Mm-hmm. So anyway, here we were up there, and here's the village of Sillooet, and water just surrounded it. Lakes, which I thought one of these lakes were so far away, and it was right near the village. So saw a lot of waterways. Yes, it was. And in a way I was happy at being able to go back, but in a way it was sad because a lot of the people we had known years back had passed away. Mm-hmm. But we did find people there that remembered our family, and we did enjoy that time visiting with making old acquaintances again.
How long did you stay there?
We just stayed a couple of days. Mm-hmm. We went over the weekend. We were on a weekend. I think we left on a Friday and came back the following Monday. Uh-huh. But it was enough time to get to see everything that we wanted to see. And one of the sad things was the old schoolhouse that we had there was torn down. The only thing left was the school bell. So we had our pictures taken in front of the school bell. That was the only thing left.
So they have a modern replacement.
Right. They had a brand new school built back further away. The schoolhouse we had was right close to the bank of the river, and I guess it had eroded, and a lot of it was getting a little dangerous. So they built the new schoolhouse back further on the tundra where we were.
Yeah, of course, the town had grown, so they needed
It had grown to 700 people or more, so it was quite changed there. But we had one of the old friends, William Sheldon. He took us for a boat ride, which was very exciting. We went up the river. He took us up a ways, and it really brought back memories of traveling on that river. So that was a neat thing. We enjoyed that.
So after 50 years.
Right.
That's nice.
Yes, it was. We were all satisfied. My older sister Muriel said she wants to go back, but I think the rest of us were satisfied that we had made that trip and were able to visit, because since we've been back from that trip to Selawik, many of the old people have passed away. So we were very fortunate to be able to find some of them there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, quite a few of your generation would still be there, but it would be your parents' generation.
Right. A lot of them. And our old nanny, we called her Nanny Cora. She was Cora Lake then, but Cora Gray. She helped Mother in raising us. Well, her daughter lives here in Fairbanks, so Cora was down here visiting too. So we've kept in touch with her, and right now I think she's back in Kotzebue visiting her son. But we get to see her often, and that's always a real special time for us, because she was so good to us, very good to us, taking care of us and helping Mother.
So the ties to Selawik are still pretty strong.
Right.
Oh, it sounds like you had a wonderful childhood there.
Oh, we did.
A lifetime of memories.
I know, we did, and we all think that it was a very special time for all of us to have been raised there. And we just really, when we get together, like my husband says, we was always talking about Selawik. But now, since our trip back in 88, we're satisfied.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me this afternoon. I've enjoyed it very much.